Good morning. On the course of its journey along the Pacific coast, Highway 101 skirts a number of Native American reservations, places where the original owners of the land are housed by the federal government, which took it from them. In recent years, certain Indian tribes have used their constitutional status to establish casinos that would otherwise be illegal in the states in which they live. But most reservations do not have casinos, and most Indians do not enjoy the wealth that they bring. Instead, they experience unemployment rates as high as 80% and chronic health problems like alcoholism and diabetes. Many Indians feel alienated and deserted by the federal government. In the late 1960s, inspired by black civil rights activism, Native Americans, through the American Indian Movement, began a campaign of their own. One of its leaders was a former resident of the Bay Area, Madonna Thunderhawk. Today, she's a grassroots activist on the Lakota reservations in South Dakota. Madonna, you're very, very welcome indeed.
Thank you.
Were you actually brought up on an Indian reservation?
Oh, yeah. Back in the 40s, 50s. Yep, that's where most of our people were.
What was it like?
Those days. Well, you know, it was a good time because we didn't know anything else. There was a certain feeling of freedom. I mean, you could walk anywhere at any time of the day or night. And that's just what I remember. We were safe and we had our families. You know, everybody was at poverty level, but we didn't know that. No, we didn't experience the outside world.
You're now in your 60s. You've had contact in your youth with much, much older people. So how far back does extended memory go? I mean, would it go back for you through talking to grandparents, for example? Would it go back as far as the 19th century?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I remember people in our communities and the gatherings, social gatherings we had. People, there wasn't story time telling like it was before my time because our people were totally colonized. I think my grandparents' generation had this feeling of you don't talk out loud, you don't do the old ways because you could get in trouble. And, you know, they were still taking children and putting them in boarding schools. So they were very careful to follow the Christian teachings and do on the surface what the government and the, you know, non-Indian people wanted to see and wanted to hear. So if there was any storytelling going on, it was told in just terms of, you know, what happened in the past and what to watch out for and what not to do.
Tell me a little bit about the boarding schools. I mean, I think they would have been more associated with your parents' and grandparents' generation, but they could be very, very nasty places to be.
Well, okay, I'm in my late 60s now, but I think I was my age group, was the last of the hardcore boarding school system. By the time I was in the 40s, 50s, there was quite a few. There was the parochial schools, Catholic boarding school. I mean, I went to Episcopal girls' school. I mean, besides the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the public school system. It was quite different from my mother's day in the 20s and 30s when she went to boarding school. It was still military. You know, run by military style in her day with the floggings and the beatings and things like that. When they spoke their language, they were, you know, really brutally treated. Well, when it got to be, like I say, in the 40s, especially World War II, I think had an influence because, of course, our people, our men and women, just signed up and went in droves. So there was a certain amount of pride, you know, and because of that, I believe. But we were still, you know, we were still marched around, and I still wore government-issue clothes, and we were still taught everything in English. Little signs, eye level, that said, speak English, you know, those types of things. And there were still severe punishments. But so it was a gradual, you know, lessening of the brutality.
When I was growing up, Native Americans were depicted on television and cinema screens as very violent, very frightening people who did not like us white folks. How aware were you as a child of that stereotype of your people?
Oh, we knew it. We knew that, you know, what Hollywood. And I'm sure there was a large part of our generation, our people, that felt like, you know, shame that, you know, of being Indian and didn't like it, you know, didn't like to watch the movies of where the Indians were always getting killed or always losing the battle. You know, personally, my family, we had strong matriarchal family. And my grandmother was, I mean, she taught us just by arguing with the radio. You know, we didn't have TV in those days, you know. And she always had an opinion, and she was fluent English, and she could speak Dakota. So she was a kind of a go-between, you know, with our people. Plus, she was a real strong Christian. But she held people's feet to the fire on a lot of issues. And I thought everybody's grandma got real angry and wrote to the governor and wrote to the president and, you know, got up in those white churches and blasted them. You know, I thought everybody's grandma did that. But, of course, she was, you know, very unique. But she instilled that in us, you know, my family, our extended family.
What was your relationship growing up with your own language?
Well, in our extended family, my great-grandmother, she was a matriarch, and she just laid down the law. She said, you know, it's a white man's world, and I don't want my grandchildren to be handicapped, so they'll speak English. So everybody talked Indian, but they talked English to us. So we knew enough to get along on both languages, but English was prevalent, and it, you know, served us well when we ended up in a boarding school where we had to speak English.
And do you speak Lakota?
I'm not fluent, no. I mean, I can, you know, I understand and I can hold my own, but I'm not a fluent speaker, no.
In the summer, in many areas of the world, places are plagued by bugs and insects. Is it true that you were plagued and bothered by anthropologists a lot?
Yeah, oh yes. It's not so bad nowadays, but, you know, in the old days it was like that, yeah. They were just, I mean, you could always tell, you know, who they were and what they wanted, and a lot of times they were ignored. They were just pests.
And did you necessarily always tell them the truth?
Oh, some people did, you know, gave them short, direct answers, never went into detail, you know, and it was good, too, that there was a language barrier, you know, because English is a very limited language, so you can't interpret indigenous languages into English very well. It never comes out right.
Now, I think you relocated from the reservation and you came to the Bay Area. What difference did that make to your life?
Well, actually, I had gone on relocation east first, went to Cleveland, Ohio, and that was, wow, that was really an eye-opener. I mean, talk about culture shock. I didn't know the air could be so dirty and, you know, so much, I mean, it was just this huge humanity of all, you know, non-Indian people. I was just, you know, I didn't stay very long. I scurried on home. But I was married young and had children, but we did know enough when we got off the reservation. I saw a lot of Indian people that I didn't know were still alive either, because we were so kept so close. We had closed societies on our reservations that I didn't know there were so many Indian people still in the East. I thought they had all been killed. And we met, you know, Indian people from all over the United States, and that was amazing. I was just totally amazed. I mean, and they were too, you know, we were all seeing each other, and we knew. We had heard, of course, you know, in the larger reservations in the western part of the country, we knew there were, you know, Navajo people and like that, but east we had no idea. So it was in that way it was a good thing, because we started seeing what was going on in the world outside of our reservations.
And then there were, when you were in the Bay Area, there were a lot of Native Americans living around the Bay Area. Was there a sense of Native American identity, or did people see themselves as Lakota, Cheyenne, Ojibwe, rather than as Indians?
Well, when we first got there, everybody did, of course. So you looked for, you know, people from your area right away, and familiar ways of doing things and talking and things like that. But the longer we were there, the more we realized that we were a people, and the outside world was totally different. And so we just kind of normally pulled together. It didn't matter where you were from, if you were Southwest or wherever. People just pulled together, and we ended up having what we called, you know, American Indian centers in these big cities where people could gather. So it was good.
When then and why was the American Indian movement formed?
Well, in the late 60s, from what I hear, okay, it started out that because of the police brutality in the cities, specifically the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, Minnesota, So it was centered around that issue, you know, because there was a lot of Native people that lived in those areas because of the Minnesota area, the tribes up there, the Ojibwe people, and the Eastern Dakotas. There was a lot of that, you know, inner city stuff that went on as far as, you know, what goes on in big cities is, you know, police brutality was the main thing. And because Indian people, I believe, this is another reason, is we're still, even though at modern days, we're still very tribal people. We still have the trappings of tribal societies. So it just mushroomed. You know, from there, there's some Indian people, and mostly a lot of the men that were involved had come out of the prison system, and they, you know, ready to move. They weren't afraid, you know. And so it just mushroomed.
And as it grew, was it more influenced by the civil rights movement of Dr. Martin Luther King, or perhaps the more muscular black resistance movements typified by the likes of Malcolm X or even the Black Panthers?
Well, you know, now this is just from my perspective of what I saw as time went by. We had a lot of respect and you know, awe for these organizations because they were finally breaking out, you know, and enough was enough, you know. And we, of course, solidarity was the main word back in those days. But with indigenous people, we were, like I said, we had the tribal way of doing and thinking. So we realized right off that our issues were unique in a way because we were land-based. And yeah, we had urban centers where Indian people were, but that wasn't by choice due to the relocation program and whatever. You know, people migrated, but they always had their home base, which was their reservation. So we became aware and we learned right away about treaty rights and land rights and inherent water rights and those things that were not given to us or granted to us. They were fought for by our ancestors, and they were many of these treaty provisions. These were ratified by the Congress of the United States and made it the law of the land. I mean, that was an eye-opener, you know. We had a unique battle. But when I realized, and many of us realized how our unique stand was, you know, where our place was in the whole scheme of things. We realized then that this is going to be, and it will be, and always will be, as long as we have a land base, it's going to be an ongoing struggle. We just needed to learn how to operate in the modern day to protect these things, you know.
You mentioned Alcatraz and the occupation of Alcatraz. That was in 1969. But go back a few years, because it was abandoned in 1963 by the federal government as a prison. And I think that a member of your family looked closely at federal law and came up with a very interesting idea.
Oh, yeah. After they abandoned it, the federal government abandoned it, there was a legal statute that said that if there was federal land, would revert back to Native people if they could make it productive. And they just got a group together and they went out to Alcatraz Island, and they didn't occupy it, but they laid claim to it under that statute. When Alcatraz happened, we heard about it and we were, oh man, it was so good to hear that. Finally, that we weren't just wanting to have what the dominant society had, like, you know, fancy cars and, you know, all the gadgets and TVs and stuff of the day. We're talking the 60s now, late 60s. We were talking about land, you know. We were talking about our birthright. So, like I say, our struggle was the same from one coast to the other, you know. When we heard about it, then we were very excited and happy that it happened.
And what was it like when you actually got there? Because the occupation itself lasted about 19 months. And I assume that it was becoming more difficult as time went on, or was it?
Oh, wow, yeah, the press had left and, you know, all the hoopla and all of that. In South Dakota, we were in Black Hills at Mount Rushmore. We were having a demonstration there promoting the fact, trying to get it into the media that the Black Hills and Mount Rushmore, the land is still by treaty, belongs to the Great Sioux Nation. So we were using that as a venue to bring up that issue. Well, at the time, Indian people came from all over, and John Trudell was one of the leaders, well, if not the main leader, of the Alcatraz, the Indians on Alcatraz. So he came, and we got to talking, and he asked if I'd be interested in coming to help organize the island, because people had left, and it was just more or less people coming back and forth, and there wasn't any real community. So I said, sure. So a friend of mine, we headed out there.
And what did you find when you got there?
There was about maybe 200 residents on the weekends, anywhere from 300 to 400 people that came back and forth. It was okay because these people, the ones with residents, are the ones that said they're going to stay. They didn't, you know, that was it. They were staying and this was, they were going to live on this island. So I just helped, chipped in where I could. We started another school because there was a lot of children on the island. And I just worked with the, rode on a Clearwater boat back and forth each day. And I worked on the dock where we had a pier where people could bring donations. And we just, I just helped build a community.
Were you aware of attempts, or was there an awareness of attempts by the FBI to infiltrate the Indians on the island?
Oh, we knew that right off because there was people greeting our boat on the dock that you could get any kind of dope or marijuana. In those days, we called it weed. It was just floating all over. We knew that was a tactic, so we were very careful. But at the same time, we weren't really, what was there to hide, you know? We talked to any press person that came and just told them everything, you know. I mean, what was there to hide? We were there, you know, and that we were going to, what we wanted to do was have a center there, a Native American center, you know, a cultural center, a school. I mean, to greet people that came into the San Francisco Bay, what would they see first? Instead of a prison and bars, they would see a cultural center of the original inhabitants. That was our plan. But of course, you know, the feds, Intel Pro, and all that kind of stuff, they made it into something, you know, or tried to make it into something that wasn't.
It was pointed out that it was a place with no water, no electricity, no means of producing food, so it was a lot like a reservation, really.
Mm-hmm. So we just had a ball. It was like going home. It was fantastic because there was Indians from all tribes there, and we just all got to know each other and got to work together, and it was really, really good. We had a lot of support. And like I said, in those days, it was solidarity. We got solidarity from all organizations, from whatever movement they were involved in, we had their support.
Were you there when the occupation ended?
Oh, no. I had left end of May because I wanted to come back to South Dakota and get my two older children when school was out, and take them back to the island. Well, while I was in South Dakota, they busted the island.
Now, in those days, though, the leadership seemed to be very male. How important was the role of women in the American Indian movement?
At the time, it didn't matter to us because we weren't fighting for women's equality or men's equality or whatever. We were fighting as a people. Whatever press we got, we knew it was going to be bad, but at least the rest of the world would know we were still here, we're still alive. And we still have a land base. So we learned early on to use it to our advantage rather than take negative and cry around about the non-Indian press, you know, because we didn't have any. We didn't have our own press or any media, Native American media. We didn't have it in those days.
Now, in 1973, the American Indian movement was involved in a lengthy siege at Wounded Knee Creek near the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. First of all, tell me something about the significance of Wounded Knee Creek to the Native American.
Well, I don't know if it's Native American per se, but for our people in the Dakotas, it's very important. That was where one of the massacres took place. After the Battle of Little Bighorn, United States Army, it was just open season after that. They were for revenge and retaliation. And that's where this chief's name, they called him Bigfoot, but that was a name that was given to him when they were putting him on the rolls because they gave him a pair of shoes that were way too big for him. But in order to get your rations at that time, you had to put on your white man clothes to walk up there and get your rations. So he'd put these shoes on just to get the rations, and they'd made fun of him and said, look, Bigfoot, you know. So that name stuck with him. Our people didn't have a written language, so who's writing all these names down? You know, it was the army. It was the enemy. So they just really butchered a lot of the names. But he's known as Bigfoot now, you know, in history. So, and he was an old man, sick and dying, and he took his band. It was just his extended family, basically, his Teoshpaye, we call it, extended family. He was trying to get to Red Cloud Agency, and they massacred them at Wounded Knee in 1890.
And then why did the occupation take place in 1973?
Well, we were on our way to the Pine Ridge Reservation because we were getting calls. We were in Rapid City. That's in the Black Hills area, the western part of the state, and we had just had a big confrontation where the Sarah Badhart Bull family, some white ranchers, had killed her son. So we were there for that reason. And we got these calls, and these people came up from the Pine Ridge Reservation and wanted the American Indian Movement people to come down there and hear their story. And everybody wanted us to come to their community so they could tell us all the atrocities that were going on. They had no venue. They had nobody to turn to. Not everybody went. Just a few carloads of us went headed on down to the reservation to meet with people. And there were the old chiefs and headmen that were still alive, and they wanted to talk. Well, then after we met in Calico, this community called Calico, in the afternoon, and then from there we were going on to the next community that wanted us to come. And that community was called Porcupine. And to get to Porcupine, we had to go through Pine Ridge. Well, as we were going through there, we just more and more cars started coming from the local people. And pretty soon we had this huge, long caravan. And as we went through Pine Ridge, we could see that behind the Bureau of Indian Affairs building, they had APCs, Armored Personnel Carriers. They had gun nests up on top of the Bureau of Indian Affairs buildings. So when I saw that, I thought, what's happening here? You know, we were all kind of uneasy. We didn't really know. But we had such a long caravan. We didn't expect that many people to join, you know, in the drive to this next community. So we saw the APCs, and so word came back that we had runners that would run back through the caravan and tell us what was happening. And one guy came running by, I told him, "You see the APCs?" Well, I didn't know they were APCs. To me, they looked like tanks. So that's what I said. These guys are armed to the teeth, you know. And so he said, "Well, we're just going to head on. We got too many people now." And when we say cars, that means families of all ages. Maybe there's a grandmother, grandfather in the car. There's the family. There's the children. They're all headed, jumped in a caravan. We're all headed northeast from out of Pine Ridge Village. So the idea was to just get to Porcupine as fast as we could. Get over there, and, you know, that way we can send everybody home and tell them what we saw so that everybody can go home, because we didn't know what was going to happen. So when we turned north, and Wounded Knee Village is right on the way to between Pine Ridge and the community of Porcupine. So that's when the gunfight started, was as we were coming down a long hill into Wounded Knee Village. And the car I was in, we were in the middle of the caravan. So we were told to just pull over and then get in a ditch. But there were so many cars. It was just, that was the main thing, was we were afraid for the people, with families that had. Well, I had my 10-year-old son with me, you know. So, you know, I wouldn't take him into something like that if it was planned. Of course, afterwards, you know, when the firefight started, then we had to decide, hey, you know, this is for real here. You know, we're under siege. We better decide what we're going to do.
You took over a number of buildings in Wounded Knee, and there was an allegation that you actually took white hostages, but that wasn't actually the case.
Oh, that was the federal officers that came in. Postal office inspectors to come in to see it because of the post office. So they were coming into Wounded Knee. So there were several bunkers, you know, that we had, you know. And so then they just captured them and turned them around and sent them back. And the people that were in there, for example, one of the preachers, I think, I don't know if he's Catholic or what he was, he decided to stay. He wanted to stay. He wasn't leaving, he said. So, well, whatever, you know, you want to stay, it's up to you. And then the other people that ran the trading post, they were just gone. They just headed out. So, yeah, it was like I said, the press would say whatever they wanted to. Whether it was true or not didn't matter.
And the FBI expended something like $5 million worth of ammunition during that siege. So, obviously, it was not a peaceful standoff.
Oh, no.
But fire was being returned, wasn't it? I mean, the American Indian Movement, you had weapons yourselves and you were returning fire.
Oh, yeah, we had people coming in all the time. It wasn't like we were trapped in there. No, we had people sneaking in and out of there every night. But every time there was a firefight, we'd expend what we had for ammunition. So we depended on those night patrols to come in and out. Some of the surrounding communities, especially Porcupine, there was different families that would that opened their homes. They'd have like a gathering station at their place, so that they'd have all kinds of food there and ammunition, and they'd fill the backpacks, and then people that would walk in at night would take them in.
And how did the siege end?
It was negotiated. I think there was so much pressure from around the world that finally the federal government they sent in Haldeman and a couple of those other Watergate guys. So the crooks were just involved in everything.
There were charges brought against you, though, weren't there? What happened with
those charges? The federal government said, you know, it wasn't a civil action, it was a criminal. And they used the post office as the basis for that. So they brought charges against everybody. It was like 380-some cases. There was five of us that were the first ones that were taken to court on that.
What happened to you?
After we were in court for about a couple months, the judge just dropped the charges. He said it was ridiculous. There wasn't any proof of anything. So on our case, there was 300 and some cases were dropped as a result of ours.
Are Native Americans, do you think, over-romanticized? We get this image of, you know, from the 19th century, the noble savage and the colonized, the victim. Are they, do you think, sometimes over-romanticized nowadays?
Well, I don't think it's as bad as it used to be. As far as the United States goes, you know, I believe there'll always be a love-hate relationship, you know, because the rank and file people, Americans, they want to look at us as romanticized, you know, and, oh, the Native American, oh, my great-grandmother. And it was always the great-grandmother, never the grandfather, you know, great-great-grandmother was an Indian princess or something. So there's that, you know, feeling. That's the way the modern days, that's the way Americans are. They don't want the reality of it, you know, that the struggle still goes on. The same things are still happening. Our people are still sacrificing to the national interest of this country, you know, United States, rather, you know, because we have a land base, so we're going to always be under siege. You know, we're going to always have to, each generation is going to have to rise up and we have to hold on to what we have.
But have the leaders of the American Indian movement not done the Native American cause damage by slagging each other off on a regular basis?
You know what? The American Indian movement was just what it was, a movement. We had no visions of, we speak for every Native American and we this and we that. There's organizations, there's tribal organizations that are capable of handling whatever. You know, we were only a movement. We kicked the doors open and that's all we needed to do. That's all we wanted to do. Because nobody knew we were even here or existed, you know. So it wasn't our plan or our intent to speak for the Native people coast to coast forever in a day, you know. And the movement was a movement of people. It wasn't a movement of leaders, of militants, of whatever you want to put on them.
And people fought out with
average,
each other.
Yeah, and they were average people. I mean, they weren't on a pedestal or anything, you know. And if they wanted to go at each other, hey, that's their thing. The movement wasn't four or five men. I was part of the movement. I'm the movement. Hmm. My family, my children, my grandchildren, my community, you know.
But, I mean, you established an organization called WARN, Women of All Red Nations. Was that because you were disillusioned with the American Indian movement and perhaps disillusioned with the role of women in that movement?
No, I wonder why that would be. I wonder why anyone would think that, you know, when it was to complement, because most of our men, because of this, the United States is male-dominated society anyway, so when they're going to attack any kind of an idea or a group of people, they go for the men because they assume that that's where the leadership is and that's where the movement is. And because they were systematically arresting and killing the male leadership that they had basically created through the media, we had to step up. There were still ongoing issues that had to be taken care of. The Black Hills issue, the ownership of the land, the uranium mining that was planned, poisoning of the water system on the reservations. When these were ongoing things, children being stolen through the state welfare system. Everybody wanted to have a Native American baby, you know. So our children were just being taken wholesale, you know. So those issues were still there. And so we understood this. So we formed Women of All Red Nations. Again, it was like a movement for the time, that time.
Tell me about the work that you do today.
It's the same. You know, it wasn't just a thing, you know, it wasn't just a fad with me or my family. It's ongoing. We're still fighting the same issues. Because like I said early on, we learned that as long as we have a land base and we're recognizable as a people, we're going to have to struggle for what we have, you know, continuously. So each generation has to pick up the struggle. And the same struggles are still there. For example, there's another company trying to mine uranium in the Black Hills again, 30 years later, you know. So those are ongoing struggles. To me, it's the privileged, you know, society that can fight for equal pay and, you know, recognition and what have you, you know. Right now, it's survival for us as a people.
And what is life like on a Native American reservation today?
Well, my personal opinion is it's just gone from bad to worse. Only the worst part is that our people are now, we've got programitis. Because of all this notoriety that we created for our people back in the 60s and 70s, the United States government just poured money into the reservations through a system of programs. Okay, a program for this, a program for that. So now our people are, I mean, we've always been colonized, but now we're colonized to the extent that we expect a program for everything. So that's just another struggle. But still, the doors, you know, once you open the barn door, you know, you can't close it. I mean, the horses are gone, you know. So it'll never go back to the way it was. But again, like I said, it's a struggle for survival. So nothing's going to ever come easy to us. Nothing's going to ever, you know, there'll be a, oh, things are just fine now. You know, that's never going to happen for us. We have a land base in the belly of the beast. Are you kidding me? We're constantly on guard. We constantly struggle.
How big a problem is something like alcoholism, for example?
Alcoholism is, I'm finding out, just like it is with many indigenous communities around the world, it's a tool of colonization. It's a tool of assimilation. And when you have a colonized people and with a dominant society that controls the economics and everything else, alcoholism is there. And now it's going to be the drugs, the meth is, it's all over this country and it's coming to Indian country real fast. So those are things that, again, part of the struggle. It's part of the struggle.
What about religion? Is that a tool of colonization and assimilation?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, just look around the world. I always, you know, Europe, that was a concept, the European concept of colonization, and that's the main thing they had. You know, they had a whiskey bottle and a gun and a Bible, you know, and just look what happened worldwide. What's no different with us here, you know? Although it's getting, because we're more, there's more indigenous media nowadays, and a lot of, you know, issues can be looked at and addressed from our standpoint. So we're not as vulnerable as we were in the past. But, yeah, religion has to back off. And, in fact, now I noticed a lot of the Christian churches are using all of our traditional spiritual ways in their ceremonies now, in their church services. They have our sacred pipes on their altar. They burn sweetgrass and cedar. And, you know, they do all these things that are part of our spiritual ways. You know, you can walk into some of those churches and you see that. And of course, they can see, you know, how strong the spirituality is with our people because we're land-based. So they're taking and using it next.
What about casinos? Casinos, this is an issue which has come up in the last decade or so. Do you see Native American reservations bringing in casinos as a form of empowerment, or do you see it as another form, a new form of enslavement?
I love it. I think it's, I mean, in your face, you know? Because this modern-day world is just everything spins on the dollar. Everything's money, 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 you know? That's the only thing that the non-Indian society understands. And boy, you want to get their attention, you know? Hey, stand toe-to-toe, you know? Our reservation, we don't have a casino. It's not. Because, you know, maybe half the population probably wants one, but we don't have the population, white or Indian, to support a casino. The larger tribes in the western part of the United States, we don't have that population to support that. But now all on the East Coast, it's, I don't know, to me, sometimes it's just, well, it's just part of it, I guess. But there's people that are white, mainly, or black, or whatever, but they've discovered that they had an ancestor and they can prove it, you know. The blood is gone, but the lineage is there. So, yeah, I mean, you have 300 people, 50 people get together and form a tribe and put up a casino, and they're millionaires overnight. So then the politics of the United States then is thinking, well, these Indians are all rich, you know. And most of the policies, federal policy on Native Americans in the United States was offspring of treaty rights. To get away from the treaty obligations, they create all these other, you know, laws and stuff to where all tribes are benefit, but it originally was a treaty provision. These tribes that are billionaires, they can still have a piece of the pie that has to come to these bigger reservations in the West where we don't have that kind of money. So we have to share it with everybody. So our health care is, you know, bottoming out, and it's just bad.
Is it time the phrase merciless Indian savages was removed from the American Constitution?
Heck no. Leave it there. Let the whole world continue to see what this country was founded on. Why should we hide that? They still think like that, hide stuff like that. Let them see what they're really, really all about when it comes to the indigenous people of the United States.